right, welcome to the Michael Slate Show. You know, there's always that moment when the drums are just starting to go and you're sitting there and you're ready to go off the edge and all of a sudden, guitars come in. What a great song. That is Let There Be Drums, Sandy Nelson. And this is the Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate, and we have a tremendous show for you today. At the back end of the show, I'm really pleased to be bringing you the director and two of the actors from a play I saw called On the Spectrum. And it's a love story. It's quite a love story. It's a love story, and it's a bigger story. It's really an interesting play, and I won't tell you any more because you're going to have to stay tuned to find out about this really unique and really moving play, all right? In the middle of the show, we're going to be talking with Sansara Taylor. Sansara comes back to our show to talk about the avalanche of assaults on abortion rights in the last few months, what's behind it, and what we can do about it. Sansara is a writer for Revolution Newspaper and the founder of the End Pornography and Patriarchy Initiative. And stay tuned for that one as well. That promises to be very hot and heavy. But opening the show up, I'm very pleased to be welcoming back Dave Lindorf. Dave's a journalist, and he writes with This Can't Be Happening, and his articles appear in many places. And I stumbled across one in Counterpunch just recently, and it really grabbed me. It was called The United Police States of America, and it's all about basically what the hell is going on and what looks like a massive kind of crackdown that's going on in society. And he talks, and the article digs into all the policies that have made what Dave calls the U.S. to be the most locked-up society in the world. Dave, welcome to the show.
Hey, Mike. Hey, thanks for having me on.
Sure. Always a thrill to have you back, man. I always know we're going to have some kind of interesting conversation here, so let's jump into it. What the hell are you – some people might say, not me, but some people might say, what the hell are you talking about, Lindorf, the most locked-up society in the world? Hey, I can walk down the street. I can go out at 2 o'clock in the morning and just spin on the sidewalk if I want, and nothing will happen to me.
Are you black?
Right. Good question.
Because you couldn't say that if you were black, and especially if you were a teenage black, and you probably couldn't say it if you're white and teenager. You know, if you're wandering down the street in the wrong place in a neighborhood or something, cops are liable to stop you. They're liable to search you. They're liable to profile you. The point I'm making is, and I speak as someone who spent some time, a couple of years, living in China, which is sort of the quintessential police state, right? And it's shocking to find out that there are more people locked up numerically, quantitatively, in the United States than there are locked up in China. We have 2.3 million in jail and something like 7 million more who are under terms of probation or parole and are under the control of the justice system, maybe even wearing a bracelet, you know, electronic bracelet in many cases these days. So they're essentially locked up. And that's a record in the world, not only percentage-wise in our population, but as a total number. And China's got four times our population. So what we've done is we've felonized everything. So I had the experience of being out every once in a while I like to hitchhike I was a veteran hitchhiker back in the day, you know, and I still like to hitchhike because it's sort of a way of sort of taking the pulse of the zeitgeist to see whether you can get a ride. And the last time I tried it, I was approached by a cop from the neighboring town because I was across the street on the town line, you know. And the guy comes up shaking his head, looking really grim, and says, "You can't hitchhike." And I said, "I don't think that's correct. The law in Pennsylvania says you can hitchhike if you're not on the road." And I was standing on the grass. And he said, "Nope, you can't hitchhike. It's against the law. And if you persist, I'll have to lock you up." Lock you up? This is a $35 fine. but this is the mentality in America. And if I had argued with him, the next thing you know is he could have charged me with, I don't know, resisting arrest, creating a disturbance. They come up with other charges to throw at you besides the one that only has a $35 fine, and you end up in jail.
Right. Or actually, again, getting back to your question that you asked me, you posed to me when I made that opening remark that a lot of people do say that kind of stuff. Well, you know, come on, this is the freest country in the world. And your point about are you black, actually, if you had been black and done that and you argue with the cop, black or Latino, you may have ended up dead. You know, that's a reality.
Well, first of all, he wouldn't have said he wouldn't have told me that I couldn't hitchhike and driven off. He would have picked me up right away, and taken me in. And second, he wouldn't have just warned me.
Well, let's talk about that, Dave.
You know, we could have easily ended up with me in worse shape.
Right. And let's talk about that because, you know, I just had Annette Dickerson from the Center for Constitutional Rights on last week talking about the lawsuit that they've got against Stop and Frisk. And one of the things that came up as we were building up for that show is that they just had finished the 5 millionth Stop and Frisk, the 5 millionth person since, I think, 2000.
New York City?
Yeah, New York City had been stopped and frisked.
Just New York City.
Yes.
A city of 8 million.
Yeah, exactly. And it's a very heavy scene there when you're talking about that. And so, you know, one of the things that comes up and what they're showing in the CCR lawsuit, and which is obvious when you just any examination of the police statistics or any just investigation talking with people about what happens in these different areas of New York. And it's not in Brooklyn Heights. It's in the West Bronx, it's in the South Bronx, it's in Brownsville, it's in Bed-Stuy. You know, it's these kinds of places where people are really being zeroed in on. And let's talk about what you found about race. What role race plays in all this? Or how is the fundamental racism and national oppression of this society concentrated in this stuff about the police state?
Well, for one thing, the majority of people in prison are non-white, right? But statistics show that the crimes committed in the country are pretty evenly spread by race, not by, within the race. Each race commits about the same percentage of crimes. So it doesn't make at all any sense to have a majority of non-whites in prison, a majority of whites in higher categories of crime, too, like on death row. That's a majority non-white also. So our justice system is corrupt in the sense that if you're black, you get convicted. If you're Hispanic, you probably get convicted. And if you're white, you walk. Or you get a downgraded charge, you know, that kind of thing. I had an interesting experience as to one reason why this works. I have never been on a jury because I've moved around a lot. And every time I get a jury summons, I end up not being able to serve because we move. And finally, I'm living in one place for 15 years, and I finally got a jury notice. And so, you know, for the county court. So I was really happy because I wanted to serve on a jury. I wanted the experience. And so you get a little card and you just fill out two things. You have to answer if you're a U.S. citizen. And it had a second question, have you ever been convicted of a crime? Right. So I checked yes because I had spent, and you had to explain it. I had been arrested at the Pentagon in 1967 and spent 3 days locked up in federal prison for that famous march on the Pentagon, you know, when Abbie Hoffman and the Yippies tried to levitate the Pentagon, that one. So I just told the truth, said yes, and then, you know, that I said it happened in 67 and so on. So then I get on, it was a winter day, I remember, my car was in the garage, so I rode a bike down to where I could catch a bus to the that would take me to the courthouse in time for the jury impaneling, and the bus wasn't coming, so I went to a phone at the local 7-Eleven. I call up the jury office, and I said, you know, I might be a little late because the bus is running late. And they said, well, what's your jury number? I look it up and call it to them, and they said, oh, you're not getting jury duty. You've been canceled. And I said, why? And they said, because you said you'd committed a crime. So, you know, I looked into it, and I found out, first of all, that my crime was a misdemeanor, not a felony. And in Pennsylvania, the law says that if you're a felon, you can't serve on a jury. But it doesn't say if you've committed a misdemeanor. And what I realized was this was a filter to keep blacks off of juries. Because every black male's been arrested for a crime. You know, the statistics are astonishing for how many black males have been convicted of crimes. So they're asking crime, and there's no record kept of that first card, right? Those are thrown out. And so there's no record of this huge filter, and it turned out that about 20 of the counties in Pennsylvania were doing this illegally, just keeping blacks out of the pool entirely so they don't even get called in.
You know, it's interesting because it's part of that whole process that goes on, which I think is actually this slow genocidal thing going on around black people. And I'll just read people some of the statistics that you've raised in your article, that blacks, while they account for 39.4% of the U.S. prison population, they are only 13.1% of the general population. And for Latinos,
three times they're being convicted and sentenced at three times the rate of their population.
Right, exactly. And for Latinos, it's 20.6% of the prison population, and they while they're 16.3% of the overall population. These kinds of things, and this whole point about race and how it's actually central to a lot of the focus of police brutality, police repression, is really really incredibly important. It also goes to, there's another thing that you brought up that I thought was really very heavy, and I wanted to make sure we get a chance to talk about this. And before we do, though, let me remind people that you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking with journalist Dave Lindorf about the United Police States of America. Now, Dave, here's a point, too. You talk about, and this has to do with the whole climate in society, you talk about children. And I remember I did a segment on my show years ago about children who are doing life in prison.
This is totally disgusting.
Yeah. And
it's something that sets the U.S. apart among all modern industrial nations. We are uniquely a pariah state, even violating the conventions on the child that we're signatories to with the UN. That my state, Pennsylvania, is the worst. We have 470 people serving life without opportunity for parole for crimes they committed as children.
Mm. It's amazing, you know. And you think about what's going on there, and what it says about the nature of this society. You know, you also talked about everything has been felonized, everything's been criminalized. And one of the things you point out, which I think is important for people to recognize too, is that these days intent is not a necessary ingredient in terms of being charged with a crime. Your intent, whatever you intended, has very little to do with whether or not you can be charged with a crime.
That's right. Remember ignorance, that line people used to say, you know, your parents used to tell you ignorance is no excuse for violating the law. Well, they take that to an extreme here. I gave an example of a father and son who went hunting for arrowheads on federal land in Idaho, and they got busted because they were told that they were digging in an architectural zone to find arrowheads, right? You know, first of all, the joke about this is if you go to any national park and go into the concessions, they're selling arrowheads. Where do you think they got those? From Indian sites. So the parks are profiteering on the violation of architectural sites of native peoples. But then this father and son who were just doing an innocent thing. I used to hunt for arrowheads as a kid. I used to find great arrowheads in Connecticut. It's a lot of fun. And here's this father and son. They're doing this innocent thing, you know, just hunting. And the ranger, instead of saying, hey, guys, you can't do that, he busts them. And they were facing felony charges for this crime. It's called a felony. And they got off with $1,500 fines apiece and a probationary sentence. This is the mentality, you know, that what I said was I discovered that the statistics show that the number of felonies in the federal criminal code is going up at a rate of about 500 new felonies added to the book every couple of years. It's now up to almost 5,000 felonies, and 15 years ago or so it was 3,500 felonies. It goes up all the time, and it only goes up in election years, which tells you something, because all our politicians want to be, you know, portray themselves as tough on crime, and what way better to be tough on crime than to write out a bill that makes something a felony? Mm-hmm. So they keep adding these felonies. Everywhere you turn around, it's a felony.
Let me remind listeners that we're talking with David Lindorf, who's from This Can't Be Happening. He's a journalist, and we're talking about his recent piece, The United Police States of America. Now, Dave, one of the things you talk about, too, which really I thought was very, very intense here, you talk about there's this, I don't know if I'll pronounce this right in terms of how you intended it, but the puny state, or the punny state. You had to, you couldn't just say.
The punis state.
Okay, you're making that up, brother.
I made it up.
Yeah, okay.
I'm coining it.
There you go. You got it. Okay, so this whole question of how this develops, and it's not just a question of what's going on in the society in terms of the breadth of it, although that's an important element of it, but the fact that today in the world, particularly focused in this country, there is no concept of rehabilitation and or treatment at all. Punishment, punishment, punishment. And, you know, I have friends who actually were telling me recently about they went through some major thing where there was a threat to their family and they were trying to figure out what to do. And this is someone who's very progressive, very revolutionary minded. And he was talking about, you know, the kind of things that he was coming up against where it was actually involved some threat to the safety and security of his family. And he said he was having a very difficult time because, you know, people were pressing him, press charges. And this person who was responsible for, you know, causing all this actually had gotten caught, totally independent of my friend. But everybody was saying, this person, they were citing what he had done to my friend, saying, this person deserves to go to jail. And he was saying, how can – you know, I keep thinking about, hasn't anybody heard of treatment? This person is clearly sick. Hasn't anybody heard of rehabilitation and treatment? People are imprisoned for – I mean, and this is an ethos we spread that gets spread throughout the entire society. Punishment. You got to pay for what you did. It's, you know, you screw them before they screw you, you know? It's a
– I was struck by the fact that this guy, Breidig, that killed the 77 kids on the island in Norway and blew up a whole center city block in Oslo that killed, you know, a bunch of other people. So altogether, he killed about 100 people and seriously injured maybe 100 more. Total whack job, right-wing, you know, crazy conspiracy lunatic racist. But... he's been sentenced to, I think, 21 years in prison, and it'll actually be a mental institution, a locked down mental institution. And at the end of that 21 years, then in 5-year increments, they'll evaluate whether he's can safely be released into society. And I thought, holy crap! You know, this country would never let somebody like that go. You know. And then I thought about the Red Army faction, you know, the Baader-Meinhof gang in Germany, who killed about 30 people in the course of a multi-year rampage through Germany, where they killed the chief prosecutor of Germany, like the attorney, it's like as if they'd executed Holder, and on top of that, several top industrialists were murdered in front of their houses. I mean, this was a real tough-ass left-wing terrorist group, and they finally disbanded themselves and sent out a memorandum saying they were disbanding. But there were people, Bader himself and some others, who were in jail, and they've all been released by presidential pardon. You know, in Europe, they don't have this sense of nobody can be redeemed, nobody can be rehabilitated. Everybody can be rehabilitated, technically. But we don't have that. We've got the opposite. We have these things like three strikes, you're out, where you go to jail 25 to life for stealing a loaf of bread, like that guy that stole some bread from a church in California.
Yeah, and did 13 years with a life sentence. This is horrible. Again, I do think it concentrates a lot about the nature of this society. The fact that everybody's atomized and it's just what you can do. I mean, you make a point that poverty's no excuse. You know, in this country, poverty's no excuse for it. Nothing you can raise as an excuse for going out and doing something. Or it's not even considered as something that might drive one. The drive to feed your family and having no work, that might drive you to go and try and get some food from a supermarket. All of these things, you know.
That wouldn't cut you any slack.
Mm-hmm.
Than just a need-based crime of not a violent crime. It doesn't matter. Shoplifting is a horrible crime in America.
Yeah.
I mean, kids, we knew a girl who was picked up for shoplifting. She was 15. Bloomingdale's picked her up. She was imprisoned by the Bloomingdale guard and held for like 4 or 5 hours without her parents being told. And then she was turned over to the Philly police, who kept her all night. She was locked up with hardened street crime kids, scared out of her wits. And what had she done? She'd lifted a cheap necklace at Bloomingdale's, you know, not one of the ones they keep locked up behind glass, just one of the ones they hang out in the open that was probably worth $10. And, I called about it. I said to the police, because we knew this girl, you know, and her parents were not educated or anything and were really kind of panicky. And I tracked down where she was, and I called the cops, and they were really irritated when I said, you know, we're talking about a 15-year-old kid. Have you gotten her a lawyer? Have you read her rights? You know, what are you doing with her? And they're saying, well, you know, we know how to deal with this. But it's really abusive, and that is, in our society, considered proper. Teach them a lesson. Scare them straight.
Okay, Dave, we're going to have to wrap this up, but thank you very much for joining us again.
Well, thank you for having me, Mike. And tell people to go to my site, thiscan'tbehappening.net, and read more about it.
There you go. And check out this article, definitely. It's really well worth reading and thinking about. Thanks a lot, Dave. Talk to you again soon.
Yep. Bye-bye.
Take care. Bye now. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate, and we've been talking with Dave Lindorf, journalist and founder of thiscan'tbehappening.net. And you want to go there to read his article, The United Police States of America, and lots of other things from other journalists as well. So check that one out. We're going to take a quick musical break, and when we come back, we'll be joined by Sansara Taylor to talk about the avalanche of assault against abortion and women's rights this year alone, what's behind it, and what we can do about it. So stay tuned. All right, welcome back. All right, that's always something that'll just jam you awake, okay? That's Anti-Flag with No Apology, and it's their statement around abortion and abortion rights and the right of every woman to have the abortion she wants and needs. And, you know, this is a, I'll tell you what, it's really a rarity to find songs that are so outspokenly pro-abortion, and I was really pleased to do that. I did a search for songs yesterday, and I found maybe 500 songs that were anti-abortion and maybe 20 that I thought were actually very good, very sharp pro-abortion songs and pro-women's rights. And joining us to talk about abortion, the avalanche of assault on abortion rights, and what's behind it, what's going on, is Sansara Taylor. Sansara has been a regular guest on this show over the years, and she is a writer for Revolution Newspaper and founder of the End Pornography and Patriarchy Initiative. Sansara, welcome to the show.
Hi, Michael. It's good to be with you.
You too. Let's jump into this so we don't waste a minute, okay, because there's so much to talk about. The last 2 years, a massive assault on abortion rights, and now this year it's become an avalanche. Anybody looking at it has to be freaked out. You know, if you come from a certain perspective, it's just sort of, whoa, what the hell is going on? Almost 300 different pieces of legislation, you know, proposed in various states, and a lot of states adopting things that probably 3 years ago people thought, maybe there's a direction, whatever, but nah, they'll never do that, you know. But there's all kinds of things going on, and there still remains a view. Unfortunately, I think in a lot of places it still remains the idea that somehow there's a friend in the White House, this thing will be held back, there's something that you know, they'll take care of it, don't worry. Even as people are getting more concerned, there's still that fundamental, it's going to be all right. You've argued opposite. What's your overview of the situation?
Well, we are in a very, very critical moment in the fight for women's reproductive rights, or actually the fight to stop the total shutting down of women's reproductive rights, women's right to abortion, and women's right to birth control. And I was very glad to hear the song that you played in the opening, and I really agree with your comments. It's very rare to hear people unapologetically upholding a positive view on the right to abortion. And that itself is even indicative. There's an avalanche of assaults. It's more and more difficult in more and more places, more and more stigmatized, more and more dangerous to get an abortion, to provide an abortion, to terminate an unwanted pregnancy. And so you already have a situation around the country where tremendous numbers of women, young women and middle-aged women, women who have pregnancies that they do not want, tremendous numbers of women are already having abortion access outside of their reach. And there are women being forced to have children that they don't want. And then there's women who have to go through enormous hurdles, enormous sacrifice, enormous burdens to access an abortion. And then you have the situation where this is why I bring up the song, there's tremendous stigma and shame and defensiveness. Even as there's the most relentless attacks on abortion, it's the mildest and meekest objections that are being raised, as opposed to, let's say, bluntly and honestly, what this is about, what this assault, which has been building for decades. But right now, we really are, you know, we're in a critical and in a tipping point period. It's a fight from Christian fascist forces and misogynist forces and forces of patriarchy to enslave women to their reproduction, to enslave women to forced motherhood, to deny and deprive women the right and ability to decide for themselves when and whether they're going to have children. And that's a form of enslavement, and that's all this is. And there's nothing to be defensive about in taking that on and countering that. It's absolutely immoral. It's very positive for women to have the right and access to birth control to abortion on demand and without apology.
Well, let's talk about this a little bit more, because there's some very specific things in this assault that's going on now. And it is very heavy when you look at the numbers just in the first 4 months. And I'll tell you, the Christian fascists are puffed up like crazy. I was reading some of their pieces yesterday, and some of the stuff that they were saying, they said, like, well, they look at the situation as the passage of pro-life legislation on steroids is the way we would describe it, the likes of which have never been seen in 40 years of legalized abortions. And they cite a pro-life chutzpah and legislative cohesiveness never before seen that has added a lot of spirit to their movement. They also talk about that the ground is shifting, that the battleground is shifting, that they've gone from, and very proud about this, they've gone from generalized attacks in terms of making access hard for women to get abortions, making access to abortions very difficult, to actually going after the very heart of things in the sense of these early trimester abortions that are getting outlawed now, and specific laws. I mean, they've taken a lot of, you know, joy and pride in getting these specific laws that go right to the, you know, right on the edge. And actually, it's ridiculous to even talk about abortion when you're looking at these early term abortions, and not even leaving the early, you know, not even liking that early term question, but just the within 6 weeks, within 3 weeks, within 2 weeks, where are they going? This is where they're going, that the early trimester abortions stop it there. And they look at that as a huge gain in what they're doing.
Yeah, well, I think it would be wrong to take them at their word that there is one strategy of theirs that's winning. But I think they are right in saying that there's a chutzpah and there's a momentum and there's an audaciousness to the assaults that is unprecedented. In North Dakota, we just had the passage of a fetal, this is the second recent passage of a fetal detection, fetal heartbeat detection ban on abortion. First in Arkansas, they banned abortion at 12 weeks, which is when a fetus develops a heartbeat that's detectable with a regular abdominal ultrasound, that is the ultrasound wand being applied to the outside of a woman's body on her abdomen, on her belly. In North Dakota, they actually passed a law which is a fetal heartbeat detection ban, a ban on abortions when the fetus heartbeat can be detected. But they are including in it, or in the language, they have not unincluded the idea of using a vaginal ultrasound, which would be to put the probe inside a woman's body through her vagina. And with that kind of an ultrasound, which gets closer to where the fetus is, and it's much more invasive to a woman's body and her person, it's possible to detect a heartbeat as early as 6 weeks. And so what this would do is, in North Dakota, it's criminalizing doctors if they were to perform an abortion for a woman who is carrying a fetus where the heartbeat is detectable, which usually happens about 6 weeks. If they were to give that woman an abortion, they could end up in prison for 5 years. So you'll have doctors who are being forced to basically invade a woman's body, her vagina, with a medically unnecessary probe, and then ban her ability to get an abortion because of this. Now, it's so twisted, because it's playing on the idea of, well, first of all, I want to say most women don't even know they're pregnant. Most women don't even know they're pregnant that early. That's like when you start to say, wait, is my period late? Have I lost track? Am I keeping track? How do I feel? Most women don't know, and especially if you're a young woman or you're in one of the many, many places in this country where you have no real sex education, you don't know that much about your biology. Most women have no idea they're pregnant at 6 weeks. So most women, I think estimates have been 75% of abortions will have become criminalized. 75% of the abortions that were provided last year would have been illegal under this new law. But the other thing is, it's playing off this idea that because a fetus has a heartbeat, and the sentimentalization and the sort of personification of fetuses, they have the potential to become human. That's what they are. They're little developing embryos and then fetuses that are becoming more and more close to becoming human. But they're being grown inside a woman's body, and the woman is a human. A fetus is not a human until it's born. It doesn't matter if it has a heartbeat. It doesn't matter if it has fingernails. It doesn't matter if it, you know, it's not a separate social being. It's not a separate biological being. It is a part of a woman's body. And so there's just gross lack of understanding of the science, which the Christian fascists have also, you know, spearheaded attacks on science, on sex education, on evolution, on any kind of understanding of what actually is going on with the development of a fetus, and total disregard and just non-recognition of the humanity of the half of human beings who are female, because they don't count. What's growing inside of them is elevated, and women are rendered, you know, nothing more than incubators in this, in the laws that are passed. And so this is just one place. I know I'm going into it quite a bit, but it's the kind of thing that they're doing. I wanted to mention one other thing, because they're coming from all sides. In Mississippi, North Dakota is one of the states that has only one remaining clinic. And in Mississippi, they also have only one remaining clinic. And that's a place where they have gone at shutting down the clinic in a different way. And I think it's important to talk about this because, and they've done it many ways, but one of the things right now is they passed a law that requires the clinic to reconfigure and meet hospital standards, which means that they have to have more emergency medical equipment there. It means the hallways need to be wider. It means a number of things that cost millions and millions of dollars to reconfigure the clinic. That are completely medically unnecessary, but they're being done once again in the name of safety and compassion for the women. The anti-abortion movement, which is the most anti-woman, the most hateful towards women, is trying to claim the idea of, we just want these places to be safer for women. If you're going to do abortions, we want the conditions better. And these are lies, but they're very confusing to the public. Mm-hmm. And they're part of what's demobilized people. They're not the main thing, but they're part of it. I just wanted to speak to that.
Right, exactly. Let me remind listeners that we're talking with Sansara Taylor, writer for Revolution Newspaper and founder of the End Porn and Patriarchy Initiative. We're talking about the avalanche of assault against abortion rights that's been going on over the last couple of years, but particularly intensified right now. Now, Sansara, I couldn't agree with you more about this thing in terms of even in this question. There's an ideological aspect of things of really digging into what are women human in all this, and do they have any rights? And I think that's the point, even about getting closer and closer to this point of like doing the fetal heartbeat and the early abortion. All this stuff is, you know, all early pregnancy, stopping those abortions, all these things. You know, it's incredible what's actually going on. And, you know, there's a point here, I think, you know, and we have about, unfortunately, we have about 6 minutes, but so I'll be fast on this. But there's, you know, included in all this, too, is the personhood laws that they're trying to pass in different places. And, you know, where fetuses, these warts inside of people have as much rights as anyone else in the society, you know, which is really pretty just mind-blowing there. And what it has to say in terms of the woman becoming being reduced to a carrier, to a pod, to, you know, this inhuman, no rights, nothing, but the wart growing inside of her becomes a full citizen. This is incredible in terms of the things that you're talking about. And I wanted to say, I want to focus on one more thing as we're moving towards the last question, unfortunately, but this whole point of you wrote an article recently in Revolution Newspaper on the site revcom.us, and you were taking on this idea that Ruth Bader Ginsburg said that the problem, the reason why all this stuff is happening around abortion right now has a lot to do with Roe v. Wade went too far too fast, that it just opened up floodgates that could no longer be controlled, unleashed this assault into the world, and it was, if only we had gone slower and step by step, everything would have been cool right now. Let's talk about that.
I think this is extremely important. I'm glad we're going to touch on this. This is, you know, it's an argument that's come up a lot, actually, in the context of the marriage equality cases being reviewed at the Supreme Court, where people on both sides of that have been citing Ruth Bader Ginsburg, who is looked to as sort of a champion of abortion rights in the courts, that she said, well, you know, maybe Roe v. Wade wasn't that. It was the right thing to legalize abortion eventually, she claims, but it was too far too fast. And like you said, this is, if it wasn't for the fact that the courts had gone so far so fast, we wouldn't have the enormous backlash that we've had since then, of all this anti-abortion backlash. And then it's being used to argue for quote-unquote moderation, i.e. tolerance of bigotry against gay people, in the rulings of the Supreme Court cases going on now around marriage equality. But the problem with this is that It's the furthest thing from the truth. The movements of the 60s and the 70s, including the upsurges which fought for and won the right to abortion, the women's liberation movement against the backdrop of a broader revolutionary upsurge, they didn't go too far too fast. Frankly, they didn't go far enough. The problem is a revolution, an actual revolution, was not made, and this system is still intact. And it is because of that, fundamentally. And this system has patriarchy, male supremacy, and the domination of women woven into its fabric and its foundation, woven into its culture, and it really requires it. It's a bigger discussion than we have time for, but it really, this system of capitalism and imperialism requires the subjugation of women. And when that was not overthrown, there are real reasons why the Christian fascist movement was not just a grassroots movement that organized better and took over the, you know, state legislatures and worked their way up to power. It was welcomed and elevated into the halls of power by very powerful ruling class figures because it serves a very stabilizing purpose for an unjust and exploitative empire to reinforce patriarchy, just like patriotism and many other negative things. And when Ginsburg is saying that it went too far too fast, she is speaking from the perspective of somebody who wants stability for the empire, a ruling class thinker and tactician, who is saying, wow, this is a very, very wrenching and potentially a contradiction, whether women will be fully human or enslaved, and around the question of whether they'll have the right to decide for themselves when and whether to have children, this could tear society open. And she is counseling for some, like many in the liberal ruling class, common ground, toning it down. And, of course, the Christian fascists never tone it down. They're more emboldened than ever. And on the other wing of the ruling class, the liberals, you have more and more of this mealy mouth, tone it down, seek common ground, and it's the worst thing that could possibly happen right now is if the people who respect women, who do not want to see women forced to foreclose their lives and have children they do not want or risk their lives to get back alley dangerous abortions, the worst thing to do would be to tone it down. So I'll end with this, which is that we need a real revolution, and you should get into what that means and what that looks like at revcom.us. And we need to fight this in ways that nobody in power is going to advocate, and many of them will condemn. We need to fight this from the bottom up with masses and thousands and tens of thousands of women and men in political mass resistance against these assaults. And stoppatriarchy.org is going to have major plans that we're announcing very soon. You can go to our website, stoppatriarchy.org, for the summer. And we are going to be out, and we're going to be in a lot of these places where these attacks are coming down, where people are isolated and on the defensive. But people need to flood into the streets, into the public places, and we need to demand abortion on demand and without apology. And so you should come to our website, get signed on to our e-list, and you should start clearing your vacation time or your summer plans, because we're going to be out in a big way and you should be part of it.
And Sansara, make sure that this show is part of it. Let's keep that this kind of rolling on, and we want to be part of actually that whole reporting and spreading the word about this. I also want to propose to you right now that we do an hour-long show related to what you were talking about, and we can take callers, you know, do an hour-long show that talks about why patriarchy is so essential to this system, why the system can't do without this, without the oppression of women. All right, how about that?
Love that.
Great. Yeah. All right. We'll have you back for that. Sansara, thank you very much.
Okay. Take care, Michael.
Take care. Bye now. All right. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate, and we've just been talking with Sansara Taylor, writer for Revolution Newspaper and founder of the End Pornography and Patriarchy Initiative. And you can check out revcom.us for her latest article and a lot of her other workings on there. That's revcom.us. We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we are going to be joined by the writer, the playwright, and actors from this play On the Spectrum, which is a really, as I said, really, really remarkable play. So stay tuned. You don't want to miss that. We'll be right back.
be in our shoes enjoying life. All we give is just true love every day. No matter the circumstances in this world we may face, our story must be told. We're here to educate. Yes, we all must learn how to communicate. Autism Speaks. We got a language of our
own. All right, welcome back. That's Autism Speaks, and that's from Carlisle Myrie. Okay, it's amazing what you can find out there musically when you search. It's actually a very cool song. Joining me now is the playwright. Well, actually, we're talking about the play On the Spectrum. And it's a remarkable play, a very powerful play. I have to tell you guys, all three of you, I got up, you know, because I was like so overcome with emotion, which, okay, maybe I'm a very emotional person. But I was so overcome with emotion, I just had to get out of the theater immediately. Aww. My wife was with me, and she's like, wait, let's tell them how good they were. yeah. I got to get to the car.
I can't sing in the state.
I was incapable of communicating.
Well, it is.
But we're joining us now is Ken Lezebnik, who's the playwright.
Nice to be here.
Yeah. And actors Dan Shaked and Virginia Newcomb, who are the two principal actors in the play.
Good. Thank you for having us.
Sure. Let's start off real quick. Ken, tell people what the play's about and why you felt compelled to write it.
Well, On the Spectrum is really a love story. It's a love story between two people on the autism spectrum. Dan plays Mac, who is a very high-functioning young man trying to go to law school, essentially passing as neurotypical for most of his life. That's been his goal. And Virginia plays Iris, who is on that end of the spectrum that is lower functioning, has a lot of challenges in communication, but communicates online. And the two, without giving away too much, meet online initially, and a romance develops. And it's a love story between these two people from different positions on the spectrum. But it's very personal to me. I have two nephews and a niece who are on the spectrum. This is the third play I've written around the issue of autism. And this one in particular was to a certain degree inspired by a new kind of online activism about autism that is examining, is autism a difference or a disability? Is it a civil rights issue? You know, if I stim, if my hands flap, is that really a disability or is that just a difference? And so the play kind of grapples with that question, but at heart it's a love story.
I'm really glad you say that because that's the thing I've been arguing with a lot of people about is like, look, it's a love story about two people who happen to have be autistic.
Yeah.
This is the point about what you've, you know, why you I was going to ask you why you did three plays on this and you've explained it well. You also, there's something there though, that there's something in this story that is so universal. You know, the characters that you've created are so, you know, I could see many a relationship I had that you two guys had. So let me talk about this because these characters are just really, really deep and interesting and engaging characters with the audience and with each other. Let me tell you guys.
I want to show you too, and I want to
say. Here's the thing. Let's start with you.
Okay.
Okay. And I didn't even get to say your name. But let's start with you, your character, Mac. All right?
Yes.
And what did you find in that character? How did you find that character? I mean, because Mac is a character who, you know, it's a really interesting person who lives on dividing lines in so many ways, you know? So let's talk about that. How did you...
You know, the first thing that I thought about is the idea of autism and the stigma behind what it means to be autistic and who is defined as autistic and who isn't. And I realized, since we're all on the spectrum, I have felt for years and years, am I autistic? People ask me if I'm autistic. I go down the same rabbit holes that Mac does in the show. I have the same nervous habits that Mac does. And I don't feel that different than the character. And I don't think that a lot of people do in the audience. I think that it's very universal. I think I went to an autistic a dance that our amazing director, Jacqueline Schultz, took us to with Virginia and Jeannie Hackett. Beckett, who plays the mother, who's amazing too. And I talked to some parents, and one of the parents said, when you meet one autistic kid, you have met one autistic kid. And so I feel the same thing about myself, is when you meet me, you're meeting me. And so if I bring the same qualities that I have to the character, the same nervousness, the same outbursts, the same obsessive behaviors that I have, then I can be Mac, and so can other people, and so can other and people in the audience can relate to that. Mm-hmm. And that's what I brought. I feel like I brought the same fears that Mac has, except they're heightened and they're maybe less contained. But when I wake up in the morning, I have the same problems that Mac does. They're just heightened. And that's what I feel about autism that I've learned, is that how do you define autism? I feel like we're all on the spectrum in some ways. Mm-hmm. We're all autistic in some ways.
You know, it's interesting because I was telling somebody earlier that the publicist for the play included in the packet this test or questionnaire. Oh, right. You know, I took it, and I have to tell you, I scored pretty high. No, I'm serious. Wait a minute. I'm going back. It's like, wait a minute. Should I change some of these question answers? But, you know, then I realized, look, you know, what's it saying and what it says about this question? Look, for too long, so many people in the world have looked at autism as Dustin Hoffman's character in Rain Man.
Right.
You know? And or another character who I forget, in one of the medical shows that was on TV, where the doctor, one of the head doctors, had an autistic child who just laid there and, all day long,
right,
and threw things around the house. You know, but that's what I'm saying, is your characters, the characters that you created, Ken, when Dan is playing Mac, you know, your character, that edge of panic and arrogance, you know, and the kind of – and there's all this stuff that goes on, the loneliness and the outwardness and the inwardness.
Right.
The confidence and the fear. I mean, all the stuff that's really, really, really heavy. And I want to talk to you – well, you can say something if you want.
I was going to say, you know, it's really – being autistic is just – interpreting things in a different way. And so as being an artist, I can relate to that. It's just you find the same conclusion, but through a different interpretation.
Let me remind listeners that you're tuned into The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with playwright Ken Lezebnik and actors Dan Shaked and Virginia Newcomb about the play On the Spectrum, a story about autistic people and a deep, deep human love story. Okay, let me ask you, Virginia, because your character actually is really interesting, because your character is – Dan's character is a high-functioning autistic person.
Yeah, he could kind of go one way or the other. It's less definable. But, physically, is definitely where I approached this character initially, because of her limitations physically, that juxtaposition with her high intelligence – I kind of worked on her in like three parts. Let's work on her physically. Let's work on her intellectually, who she knows she is but can't quite express, and then putting all of that together. And really, it's Iris is a menagerie of these different things that I've researched, including autistic children, animals, you know, people that I know that I took little pieces from, history that I have with other illnesses that I'm able to mimic muscularly. I put all that together like a puzzle piece, and then, you know, and then try to express it in a fluid and consistent way. But, you know, the hand gestures, that's something that I've kind of had in me, kind of filed away since a kid, because I grew up there's a rare disease that runs through my family called DERPLA. It's similar to Huntington's chorea, which is a lot like Parkinson's. So it's a brain degenerative disease, and some of the muscular manifestations are similar. Mm-hmm. So that's something I just was able to express and able to use because I had that filed in there.
But there's something else in your character beyond the physical. The physical was amazing, but there's something else. There's the vulnerability. There's the inside and outside contradiction. Yeah. There's the confidence that gets expressed, oddly enough, inside the apartment and in the other world, the website.
Her imagination and the freedom that gave me as an actor to play is exhilarating, because she doesn't have she didn't take the classes. She didn't grow up like Mac, becoming normal, being put into this box. So So all of Iris has just been kind of bounced off of her own walls in her own apartment by herself, and all she has to bounce off is her and her imagination, mm-hmm. which is freeing, but then, you know, at certain parts of the play, extremely frightening.
But then she meets Mac, and all the self-confidence that she's built up, it teeters on this edge of sort of, whoa, I'm also very vulnerable.
Oh, mm-hmm. extremely. Mm-hmm. Which is, childlike, you know, she kind of reverts to this, I mean, socially completely unaware and...
I want to have you guys actually do a piece from the play just to give people a taste of it. And then we'll come back and we'll get a couple more questions in. I think we have about 6 minutes, so you can do whatever you want.
And just to preface this, too, this is a part of the play that is a voiceover that I've recorded for a voiceover. So because Iris doesn't speak very much in the play. So this is kind of an idealistic voice of her.
And it, so in the context of the play, this is actually a series of messages that they exchange via online.
Right.
So this is like an online chat.
Don't let them tell you autistic people never fall in love.
Okay. I have Asperger's.
So you're autistic, like me.
I'm on the spectrum.
You're autistic. I'm autistic. Do you have trouble with that?
No. Why would I have trouble with that?
You're not one of those, I've got Asperger's, which is super cool, but autism is a drag, people. Are you?
No. But I do have Asperger's.
Well, we're all autistic.
Asperger's is a separate diagnosis.
It is until May 2013, then the new DSM-5 comes out.
I think that's bull****. I know of Aspies who go to grad school, who are college professors, who are incredibly high achievers in society. And then I see this profoundly autistic kid who can't keep a conversation. He can't keep his room clean or himself. He's picking at his scabs and he's stimming all the time. And you want to say that he has the same diagnosis as a college professor?
That's the argument they use to divide us.
Does that mean it's wrong?
They're trying to divide and conquer.
I don't think they're trying to do anything. They should just get a better diagnosis.
Well, I never like being put into a box. Asperger, low functioning. And I hate that term, Asperger, anyway. It's like Asperger, like burger from an ass.
All right.
Bombs
there you
and
go.
Bombs and bombs.
I want to give you each a chance, and especially you, Ken, because I'd spent a lot of time with these guys. Mm-hmm. The play. Let's talk about this, the relationship. I really want to talk about this overall thing. You know, what really struck me was not just the love, but the growth of this ability to communicate, both with each other, which was a big challenge, but then also to communicate with the outside world as well. Each one of them has to in some way break through a door and get to the outside world, which is really very, very – it was very intense. So let's –
Absolutely.
That.
And I owe a great debt of thanks to this incredible cast and the director, Jacqueline Schultz, who is just a phenomenal director. And thank you for that observation, because that is absolutely – and I'm glad it came through in the play. The growth of communication, which is reflected by all the characters. And I was inspired to a great degree by the phenomena over the last – really – 10 years or so of people on the spectrum who have found incredible release in their ability to communicate by being online. And it opened up this enormous door to people so that they could no longer feel like I am alone, but now I have somebody in Austin, Texas. I have somebody in Australia that I can communicate with who is like me. And that shared sense of community has really blossomed, and it's opened up tremendous possibilities for people who I think in previous generations felt totally isolated.
But there's another thing too, which I'm going to slip this in. I'll give you unfairly about a minute to talk to it. But there is, and either one, all of you can actually comment on this a little bit, say, at the time yourselves. Okay. but there is this point of, yes, it's communicating with each other. But there is also this point about communicating with the outside world, each one of them. You know, and even to Mac actually has to make a certain breakthrough in terms of even his ability to make eye contact with people and whatnot, mm-hmm. you know. And Iris has to brave that step outside of her apartment, not in her mind, but actually physically. Yeah. And everyone else, the mother has to make the step to accept what is a genuine love story, you know.
Yes.
And to me, there's actually and I do have to say that even that point, I have to give you credit for this really great line about the point where, Dan, your character makes the point about, I've spent all my life learning to communicate with people.
Right, the texting.
And now they're all doing it on computers.
Right.
So but let's talk about that for just – we have literally – maybe I'll give you 30 seconds. Okay, quick.
Well, the communicating with the outside world is a wonderful piece of what I think happens during the course of the play. And you noted that Iris takes, and Jacqueline called it, this sort of hero's journey, mm-hmm. where she has to leave her isolation of the world she's used to and then journey through the city to come to Mac's apartment. And that's this brave step into the real world from the fictional other world that she has created this website around. Mm-hmm.
Actually, we got to run. We're running out.
You said it.
That's it. You got it, Ken.
All right. Unfortunately, we have to draw to a close. But you've been listening to a conversation with Ken Lezebnik, the playwright of the play On the Spectrum, and Dan Chiquette and Virginia Newcomb, two of the actors in the play. And it's a play about not just about autism and about the life of people who have autism, but it's a very deeply human and inspiring and encouraging love story. A really, really remarkable piece of work. And that just about brings us to the end of yet another show. I want to thank all of my guests today, Dave Lindorf and Sansara Taylor and the folks from the play On the Spectrum. I also want to thank each and every one of you for tuning in. If you want to get in touch with me, you want to write at me, you want to holler at me, you want to yell at me, you want to just like see what I'm doing, follow me on my blog or go through to Facebook or Twitter, or you can write to me at michaelslate@redfuture.com. Again, that's michaelslate@redfuture.com. And before we leave, I just want to let people know that if you are one of these people who have been looking around for answers to why society is as screwed up as it is and how it can change and if you're wondering, is it really possible to change all that? I really highly recommend that you visit the site revcom.us. That's revcom.us. Go there and check out the section on Bob Avakian and check out in particular the film of a speech he gave last fall. It's a really brilliant film. It came out, it premiered just a couple of weeks ago, and you can get it as a DVD right there on the site. But check it out. It's BA Speaks, Revolution, Nothing Less. If you're looking for a way to change the world, you have to check this film out. So don't miss it. That's at revcom.us. Okay, and now we really got to get out of here. But before we do, I want to thank my engineer for today, Teddy Robinson, my assistant producer, Henry Carson, and remind all of you that you've been tuned into The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host and producer, Michael Slate. We're going to go out now with a song that was one of my favorites when I was a kid, and it's a song that I used to blast out as loud as I could every day before I left the house. It just put me in the right kind of mood for the rest of the day, and I think it still does today, and I'm sure I'm not alone in remembering this song or how you're going to feel after you hear it. It's We Can Be Together from the Jefferson Airplane. Check it out and talk to you again next week.
I'm the